This podcast is brought to you by AJ Bell and Shares Magazine. Shares Magazine is published by AJ Bell Media, part of AJ Bell.
Hi there, my name's Dan Coatsworth. Welcome to our fourth podcast dedicated to investment trusts. Now, this is a bonus podcast that runs once a month alongside the normal weekly AJ Bell Money and Market Show. But joining me this week is Laith Calaf.
Yeah, thanks, Dan. Now, in this special podcast, we discuss hot topics in the investment trust world with a range of experts and fund managers. We have educational content to help get you up to speed if you're not familiar with investment trusts, and we'll also debate the most popular trusts on the market.
Now, one of the differences between traditional funds and investment trusts is that the latter have a board of directors. Now, they're meant to keep a check on what the manager's doing and uphold high levels of corporate governance, but that doesn't always happen.
That is right, and that's why we've got James Carthew from the research group Quoted Data on the show to talk about what the board should really be doing.
Now, we've also had some listener requests to look at Ruffer Investment Company, and your wish is my command. So Tom Sieber and Martin Gamble from Shares Magazine are here to talk about what Ruffer is doing and also the broader capital preservation space.
And the MIGO Opportunities Trust knows a thing or two about how to find bargains amongst investment trusts. So we've got the co-manager, Charlotte Cuthbertson, with us later in the show to explain what trends and opportunities she's seeing at the moment.
And to round things off, we're going to take a look at the world of private equity because the UK financial regulator has got a bee in its bonnet about a few things in the industry. So joining us to talk about what the FCA is reviewing is Alan Gold from Patria Private Equity Opportunities Trust.
Okay, well, first up, let's cover one of the big news stories in the world of investment trusts. Fundsmith is a pretty well-recognised name amongst open-ended fund investors as a result of the very successful and the ginormous Fundsmith Equity Fund. But the fund management group also runs a mid- and small-cap investment trust called Smithson, which seems to be surrounded by a fair amount of controversy at the moment. Tom Sieber from Shares Magazine is here to give us the lowdown. Tom, can you just bring us up to speed? What's been going on at Smithson?
Absolutely, Lace. So, as you say, Smithson is from the same stable as Terry Smith's popular Fundsmith Equity Fund, and it's got a pretty similar philosophy. So this buy good companies, don't overpay, do nothing is the strategy, but it applies it to small and mid caps rather than the market's really big companies. It launched in 2018. It was the biggest investment trust launch ever then, and it had a pretty strong first few years of performance, but it struggled more of late as its kind of investment style has come a bit out of fashion. So on a three-year view, it's delivered annualized returns or negative annualized returns. And even on a five-year view, it's only achieved a pretty meager annualized return of 4.5%. So just to come to the recent controversy, it's quite common for trusts to have a provision in their articles of association to hold a continuation vote, perhaps every 3 or 5 years. Sometimes they have conditional triggers as well. So they'll have to hold a continuation vote if the market value falls below a certain level or the discount to net asset value is persistently at a specifically kind of wide level. At inception, Smithson had said to investors that if the trust's average discount in any single financial year was greater than 10%, it would consider giving shareholders a vote on its future. And in Smithson's latest financial year, its average discount was 10.7%. So in theory, it should have triggered a continuation vote. But despite hitting this threshold, the board's chair, Diana Dyer Bartlett, wrote in the trust's annual report that there wouldn't be any such votes. And the reasoning was that the discount related to broader market conditions rather than being anything specific to the trust. And Dyer Bartlett also flagged that it had had strong performance in terms of the net assets, at least, and that the board had confidence in its future prospects. I suppose, in fairness, it had only ever said it would consider, in inverted commas, giving shareholders a vote. But the fact that it decided not to caused a real stink, and it's probably one that the board should have seen coming.
So obviously we had that, but that's not the end of the story, is it, though?
No, it's not, absolutely. So just to sort of go into a bit more detail on the reaction at the time, Peter Spiller from Capital Gearing Trust, whose voice carries a fair bit of weight in the market and whose fund has a material stake in Smithson, said he was horrified at this decision and he pledged to vote against Dyer Bartlett's re-election as chair. Perhaps inevitably, Smithson was cowed into a U-turn, but because it initially suggested it wouldn't allow shareholders to demonstrate their own confidence in its prospects, they created a situation where a vote, which would in all likelihood have been a formality, turned into a bit of an embarrassment. So investors did vote for the continuation of the trust, but 9.6% of votes cast were against. Nearly 20% of votes were cast against the re-election of Diana Dyer Bartlett as chair. And there were 10.2% votes cast against the reappointment of Lord St John of Bledsoe, who's chair of the audit committee. So they've really paid a price for not kind of sticking to what they said at the outset and not being transparent. And all right, you know, it was only 0.7%, you know, above the threshold that they talked about. But they talked about that threshold. And I think they've really paid a price for not sticking to, like I said, sticking to what they said they would do at the outset.
Well, thanks, Tom. It's pretty interesting that Smithson's facing some pushback about the board of directors, because that's actually one of the key topics that we'd already had planned for this week's podcast. So, you know, investment trusts often say that they've gotten an advantage over traditional funds because they have this extra layer of governance through having a board of directors. But as we mentioned at the start, it's not always effective. So to learn more about this topic, we've actually invited James Carthew from research group Quota Data back on the podcast. Laith recently caught up with James, and this is what he had to say.
James, thank you very much for joining us today to talk about the role of the Investment Trust Board. Just to kind of kick us off, can you give us a brief overview of what an Investment Trust Board does and who are the key personnel within it?
Sure, thank you. So basically, the board's there to represent shareholders' interests. Their job is to make sure everything's run by the company properly. And they're normally led by a chair that's elected by those directors. And then they'll form a series of subcommittees to manage all the individual little bits of the business. So there's probably going to be an audit committee whose job is to make sure the numbers are okay. And then there'll be a remuneration committee that decides how much they get paid and how much they pay things like the manager. There might be a manager engagement committee. It totally depends on the size of the board whether they do all these things. But they're just looking at all the individual bits of how the company works and making sure that's all done as efficiently as possible.
Okay. And, you know, how important is the board compared to, say, the investment management team, who obviously look after the investments and make all the investment decisions?
The board's job is to set the strategic direction of the company. So they're not supposed to be interfering in the day-to-day management decisions. That's jobs they've outsourced to the manager. But they're there to make sure that the risk controls are adhered to. They're there to make sure that the costs are kept as low as possible. And they're there just as an oversight, as a sort of checks and balances to make sure the manager's doing their job properly.
Yeah, so to keep the manager honest, basically. And mm-hmm. And clearly those directors, that board is all paid out of the trust assets, which is, you know, ultimately paid by investors. So, I mean, can we actually point to any sort of tangible benefits that investment trust boards deliver for investors? So obviously there's this government role that they fulfill, but what is there anything kind of investors can hang their hat on and say, yes, I'm definitely getting that from having a board structure?
For most trusts, the cost of the board is de minimis in the great scheme of things. I mean, compared to the fees that the manager gets paid, it's normally an awful lot lower.
Right.
And some boards actually have set limits on the amount that the board is allowed to get paid overall, but that's not across all boards. But in terms of whether they're good value for money or not, I think the big thing is when they can keep the fees low, the manager fees low. So if you think that you could easily have a fund that is paying manager fees of like sort of $1.5 million a year, and the director's fees might be about $200,000 a year, and it's not uncommon for them to come up with things that tap the manager's fee, and you end up seeing savings of more than $200,000 a year, or you know, $200,000 over 2 years. So those sorts of things be quite material.
Yeah.
But generally keeping the cost of everything low. So the cost of the auditors, the cost of the custodians, the depository, the lawyers, the brokers. There's so many different moving parts within managing an investment company.
Yeah, okay. And I mean, I guess ultimately they do have the opportunity to replace the investment manager as well if they're not happy with performance as well.
Yeah, that is, to my mind, the greatest strength of the investment company structure, is that when things aren't working, the board is there to sort that out. And they can normally do that fairly quickly and efficiently, compared to like an OEIC, for example, where they're technically got boards, but they're sort of tied up with the manager and the administrator, and they're not really independent. These are very much independent. So every single board member has to be independent of the manager. Well, they don't have to be, but the majority of them has to be. And it's now quite rare to see a representative of the manager on the board. And that independence means that they can look quite critically at whether the manager is doing their job effectively or not. And they'll look at things like value for money that we've already talked about, but also they'll look at performance and just also the big picture strategic direction. So if a company's trading on a big discount to asset value, that's normally a sign that the shareholders aren't entirely happy. So digging into the reasons behind that and fixing them is another big chunk of what they do. And that's hard to value and put monetary terms on. But actually, I suppose, you know, if you're on a 20 discount and it goes to zero because of actions by the manager's taken, that's for you as an investor, that could mean, you know, that you actually make a lot more money. So their influence can't really be underestimated, I think.
Okay. And I mean, you mentioned open-ended funds there and the boards that run those. And we have had some changes in the open-ended funds world recently. So, you know, the boards aren't independent, but they do now have independent members. We've got value for money assessments from open-ended funds. And we've also got this new overarching consumer duty that affects all financial services companies from the financial regulator. So, you know, given all that, which applies to open-ended funds, is there a case for saying, well, actually, the gap between, you know, the governance of investment trusts and open-ended funds has closed because actually open-ended funds are now more like investment trusts in having more independent structures?
A bit at the margin. Honestly, I do think it is only a bit. Actually, because I still cannot conceive of an open-ended fund board firing a manager and replacing them. I just cannot conceive that would happen. Whereas it happens really quite often within the investment company sector. And if they're not firing managers, they're thinking, should we be bigger? Should we be merging with somebody else? Have we actually got completely the wrong strategy? Should we not be looking at small cap? Should we be looking at large cap? Should we be doing something that's more environmentally minded? There's so many things that the boards do in the investment company sector, and it just makes it more dynamic. And I think it just keeps the investment company, it keeps nudging it towards something that's a bit more optimal. And I think it's one of the reasons why investment companies tend to outperform open-ended companies over the long time.
Okay. I mean, we've got a very good idea from that, thanks, James, of kind of what the board is doing and the kind of value that they add. But I think it is fair to say, is it not, that, you know, there have still been failures in the investment trust world, you know, stretching back to many years ago with the split cap investment trust scandal. You know, more recently we've seen problems with, you know, kind of Hipgnosis and Chrysalis and you know, stretching back to Woodford Patient Capital, where, you know, there's been controversy, should we say. So they're not an absolute guarantee of plain sailing, are they?
No, they're not. And I wouldn't want anybody to go away thinking that. There have been individual failings. I think that's entirely true. I think there are individual boards that can very rightly be criticised. It tends to be in situations, really, where everybody's got a bit overexcited about an investment opportunity and everybody's in love with the manager and they just sort of... stuff gets past them that shouldn't get past them. There's probably not enough critical thinking going on. They are fortunately relatively rare. I mean, I know we can also make examples, but they are relatively rare. And the beauty of the investment company structure, again, is that if you don't think that your directors are doing a good job, you as an investor can fire them. And that is what's happened at Hipgnosis, for example. So the investors got together and said, look, patently, the board is not in control of what the manager's up to. We don't feel that this situation is good enough. So we want a change of board members. And it wasn't done through a sort of proxy vote, of actually kicking people out in a meeting, but it was all done behind the scenes. We've got a new chairman, got some directors stepped down. That all has put the whole thing back onto a path where now we've got people fighting over it in terms of bids. So we had another counter bid this morning. That's all great news, really. Again, the board structure does enable these, when the problems arise, it enables things to get sorted out.
Yeah, and I guess that is an important point, is that ultimately kind of the board is responsible to shareholders mm-hmm. in a very direct way, isn't it? In a way that I guess yeah. your investment manager in a typical fund is not. So yeah, that's my point taken.
Again, it's this thing about they're accountable to you as the shareholder, as the investor. So you can turn up to the annual general meeting. You can ask questions face to face, and you can talk to other shareholders and get together and force votes through and get things changed. And you know that power that you have as an investor with an investment company is just so much greater than you would be if you're in an open-ended one. And I think again, it's another key difference.
Yeah. Okay. And just finally to wrap up, just looking at discounts. Obviously, there's quite a lot of quite wide discounts in the investment trust world at the moment. Should boards be doing more to reduce those discounts, and kind of what are the tools available to them if they want to do that?
They've been quite proactive, really. Far more proactive than they were last time we had a discounts this sort of size. There's been a swathe of share buyback activity. So shrinking the shareholder base, shrinking the number of shares in issue rather, is a good way of trying to match the supply and demand and improve the discount. There's been a lot of mergers going on, some takeovers going on. There's lots of kind of corporate activity.
Yeah.
There is a limit because where the discounts are worst is in the alternative asset sectors, where the underlying investments are really quite illiquid. If you're going to invest in wind farms or solar farms or private equity or property, it absolutely makes sense to do it in a closed-ended structure, because you give an open-ended fund, you can't deal with money rushing out the door and money flooding in. But you do get this tension that means that you get the discounts opened up, and it is much harder to fix discounts in those sorts of environments where you can't sell the underlying assets and buy back the shares. So it's about fixing the demand. And part of the reason for the problem with the lack of demand, it comes back to a problem around cost disclosures, which is incredibly complicated and not worth going on to here. but there's been a lot of backs and forwards that basically professional investors have been discouraged from buying these things, because if they buy them, it makes their costs to their clients look bad. And it's a purely optics thing, not like, something that's found in reality. And that has caused a kind of buyer strike, which is one of the reasons why the discounts have got wide. If that gets fixed, we could see discounts come rattling in, hopefully quite quickly. I'm not promising that will happen, but it's one of the things that we've sort of got our fingers crossed and hoping we'll see.
So that was James Carthew from Quoted Data. Now, Tom was on earlier on about talking about Smithson and how Peter Spiller from Capital Gearing was amongst the big investors who'd been criticising the trust board. Capital Gearing is one of the most popular capital preservation trusts, which leads us neatly into the next segment of the podcast. And we've had quite a few people get in touch and ask us to look at this space, including a chat about Ruffer Investment Company, one of the big investment trusts in the sector. So to learn more about what Ruffer and Capital Gearing do, let's bring Tom back on, and also Martin Gamble from Shares Magazine.
In 2023, popular investment trust Ruffer Investment Company endured its worst year since its 2004 launch, with the company falling well short of its remit of not losing money. by serving up a negative real returns of 6.2% compared to a 7.9% rise for the FTSE All Share. This raised some questions about whether the weak showing represented a blip or was the start of a more negative trend. But before we explore that further, Martin, could you explain what capital preservation funds are and what are some of the other main names available to UK investors other than Ruffer?
Sure. Well, in general, they are designed to protect investors' capital primarily, but then also to grow wealth over time in a conservative manner. So they're not just about preservation, they're also about growth.
Sure.
But that's the main kind of focus. And I think with Ruffer, they claim not, or they try not to lose money in any single year. Whereas the other trusts that also call themselves capital preservation, like Capital Gearing, Personal Assets, which is managed by Troy Asset Management, they focus on capital preservation, but they're more of a, they focus more on the growth side of things at the same time. So, but they're all trying to preserve capital first, but grow wealth, because they know that over time people need their wealth to be ticking up.
And there's another name which sort of sometimes gets pulled into that group, which is RIT Capital. It's, I guess, set up by a branch of the Rothschild family, isn't it? So,
yes, I mean, that can be used as a capital preservation vehicle as well, but I think that's only a part of the overall portfolio offering. But yes, some people do use it as a capital preservation vehicle. And there's also, there's a fund that is also in that sector, Latitude Asset Management, run by Freddie Late. And that, again, claims to be a capital preservation. So he runs half the portfolio in bonds, the other half in the stocks that he likes, the long-term growth stocks he likes. And he compares favorably with the trusts that are on the market too. So it's worth considering.
What about with those trusts, what sorts of things would they be investing in order to try and preserve capital? Perhaps not so much Ruffer, because obviously we'll go into that in some depth, but the other trusts that you mentioned.
Yeah, well, I mean, they kind of, it's a bit like an insurance policy, I guess, where you don't want to buy. Apparently, a lot of people buy house insurance once the house is burnt down or the demand goes up.
And,
but you want the policy in place before it happens. So these trusts position themselves for kind of not worst case scenarios, but for balancing some of the risks that are building up in the market. So, you know, there are a lot of these personal assets and capital gearing, they have big weightings towards gold, fixed interest securities, TIPS, so inflation linked bonds. So they provide a lot more protection if markets, stock markets, risk assets in general perform poorly.
Sure.
And you could argue we're at a time when, like I was trying to think earlier, you know, what's actually not trading near an all-time high? Bitcoin, which is presumably some people think is a gold proxy, near all-time high. Gold recently hit all-time high. Copper, industrial metals, the price of oil with the rising geopolitical risks. And even credit, you know, credit spreads are some of the tightest on record for both corporate grade or high grade and low grade credit. So there's not a lot of risk. There's a lot of risk taking going on and not a lot of risk protection kind of in investors' minds. If you look at the asset classes, so these funds are positioned kind of on the opposite side of that. So what would happen if it all went wrong?
And absolutely. Well, let's return to that. In a bit. Let's go back to Ruffer and look at that in a bit more detail. So undoubtedly it had a really difficult year last year, largely because some of its sort of more unconventional investments, which were aimed at protecting the portfolio, actually acted as a big drag on performance. And it's notable that the investment manager, Ruffer Investment Management, is talking about cutting jobs. So it obviously, you know, this bad year has had a tangible impact. But if you look at the longer term, the trust has a pretty impressive record of insulating against market falls, notably in 2022. So not all that long ago, when the market had a bad year, during the COVID-19 pandemic and during the global financial crisis, the managers have the freedom to go anywhere and invest in pretty much anything. And the trust has demonstrated it has the ability to delve into some asset classes that really retail investors wouldn't or couldn't invest in themselves in order to make money. So that could be owning Swiss bonds, Japanese yen before the financial crisis. So that's a trade that works out pretty well for holders of Ruffer. They invested in Bitcoin in 2020, for example, briefly. And they use sort of complex derivative instruments like volatility call options and credit protections. And if you look at the way it's positioned at the moment, the trust is notably bearish on equities, and it's positive on assets like gold. You mentioned inflation-linked bonds earlier. They're positive on that, and commodities. And that's really predicated on a belief that inflation is going to stick around amid significant indebtedness, particularly amongst sort of global governments. In 2023, as we discussed, the Japanese yen, the inflation-linked bonds, and the credit spreads and volatility call options were the big detractors from performance. And it's interesting, when fund manager Duncan McInnes recently spoke to Shares, he said that the team had decided to call it an ugly duckling portfolio because, to quote him, it was a collection of assets that we really like, but which have been totally shunned by most investors. As you were sort of starting to talk about earlier, Martin, there are some reasons to think that there could be a bit of a change afoot and that capital preservation might return to favour.
Yes, I think with all the asset risk assets trading at all-time highs, then it probably makes sense to think about the other side of it and what would happen if it all went wrong. And there's a lot more risk out there than probably people realize, not just the geopolitical ones, but financial ones as well. And, you know, I think Ruffer make a good case that inflation probably will stick at higher than people think, and certainly higher than the 2% that prevailed before the pandemic.
Yeah.
I mean, they point to, you know, wartime deficits being run by the governments across the major economies, and unemployment in the US at 50-year lows. And they say, well, even if you had a small recession, surely those deficits would become more of a problem. So that plays into their inflation theme as well. So I think they make a good case. And, you know, you look at their portfolio, 50-odd percent is in short-dated bonds, credit derivatives, 13%, gold, 4%. I mean, they do have a small equity holding, but as you say, they called it the ugly duckling portfolio. And they have some exposure, for example, to China, which is they think is extremely unloved at the moment.
Mm.
And they play that through an ETF. They've also got a holding in Alibaba, which has got 30% of its market cap in cash. So they've got some holdings, which I guess would be considered ugly ducklings. So yeah. if the world were to fall apart, presumably they would perform better.
Yeah, and I guess, you know, I mean, you know, we're not obviously in the business of giving investment advice on this podcast, but even if you don't have as negative a view of the outlook, or you kind of, you know, these trusts offer, like you said, I think earlier on, a bit of an insurance policy against, you know, the market's not continuing to go up and there being some volatility, because that's what they're built to do. They're built to sort of, you know, endure that volatility. So, you know, that it kind of explains why they might have appeal to investors, you know, regardless of their overall view of what might happen in the markets.
Sure. And, you know, with Ruffer, I think historically it's traded at a premium.
Yeah.
And it's had 2 years, as you pointed out, 2 years out of 20, which is not actually delivered on its positive return, which is amazing, which is why it was trading at a premium. Now you can buy it at a discount. So not only are you getting protection from things not working out as the consensus believes, but you're also buying the underlying assets here at a discount to their value. So there's an extra sort of value implied there.
Absolutely, yeah. So you're right to say that I think the discount is unusually wide at around 5.8%, having traded at a premium for quite a period before that. Though, interestingly, you have started to see that narrow a little bit in recent weeks as the market backdrop becomes a bit more volatile. The other thing to say with Ruffer is that the ongoing charges are higher than they would be for perhaps a more straightforward fund or trust at around a little over 1%, 1.07%, according to the Association of Investment Companies. That does compare somewhat unfavorably with the other capital preservation trusts. But I guess if you look at the complexity of what Ruffer is doing, perhaps that explains why those charges are somewhat higher.
Yeah. And I guess another angle is to consider, if you're potentially considering it as an investment, is they do have this, what they call unconventional protection or basket. And it's hard for an outside investor, especially retail, to understand what they're actually doing. So you have to kind of trust that they know what they're doing and that they're putting on these trades in a in a way which does protect investors and it doesn't blow up at any time. I mean, historically, they've done very well, so we can assume that they are very good at what they do. But it's just another aspect which differentiates Ruffer from the other options in the sector, which are more sort of plain vanilla investments, which you can understand.
Okay, thanks to Tom and Martin from Shares Magazine. Now, as always, let us know which trusts you'd like us to discuss on our monthly Investment Trust podcast, or indeed anything else you'd like to hear about. You can contact us on the email address podcast@ajbell.co.uk. Now, previously on the podcast, we have discussed the large number of discounts available on the market for investment trusts. And to get a view on the biggest bargains out there and the areas that might no longer be cheap, Dan spoke to Charlotte Cuthbertson from MIGO Opportunities Trust, which is a rather interesting vehicle. Instead of investing in a portfolio of stocks or bonds, this investment trust basically looks for other investment trusts that might be trading on unusually large discounts, or potentially where the managers see an opportunity for a discount to narrow. So let's hear from them about what they're seeing in the market at the moment.
So Charlotte, I mean, the investment trust space is full of bargains. It has been for quite a while. But where are you seeing the best bargains at the moment in this area?
Yeah, I mean, the investment trust sector has had a pretty tough 18 months. You've had sort of two pillars that have really pushed discounts very wide across the sector. So you've got sort of the market macro side of interest rates and inflation, which has undermined, several areas of trusts, including, probably most notably the alternative income sector and some of the sort of earlier stage sort of private company trusts. And then obviously you've got the sort of the OCF issue, which has kind of further put investment trusts under the cosh. And we're, there's an enormous amount of opportunities across the board at the moment. I mean, discounts haven't been this wide since 2008. So particularly what we've been looking at are those two areas I've just mentioned. So the two sectors that have been particularly hard hit by rising interest rates and inflation. So early stage companies, what we like to say is we're looking for sort of arbitrage opportunities between perception and reality. So for trusts like from Space, Chrysalis, Augmentum, FinTech, lots of investors think that these trusts have, very young companies, and have been very worried about kind of valuations in terms of their underlying portfolio companies, especially when we saw the sort of frothiness of 2021. But actually the reality is quite different. You've got very sensible companies who are, lots of them are actually profitable or have a pathway to profitability. And the market is sort of discounting that and believes that it's they're far more risky and valuations are still very frothy. And we don't believe that that's the case. And so we've been able to invest in some of these trusts on very large discounts, anywhere between sort of 40% and 50%. So basically, you're buying really great growing companies at sort of 50 pence in the pound. And on the other side, the alternative income trusts have been really interesting. Areas like renewable energy, infrastructure, alternative income, because, these trusts were launched to give investors access to yields when, yields on a gilt were very incredibly low. And as the yields in treasuries and gilts have increased, investors no longer sort of have necessarily needed these trusts and have moved into that space, which has undermined a lot of share prices. But again, some of these trusts have really great assets. And their share prices are now so low that often they're sort of yielding sort of 7.5-8%, which does still look, very attractive in comparison to sort of a gilt yielding around 4%.
I mean, can you give me perhaps an example of one of these trusts that you've picked up and why it caught your eye?
Yeah, so I guess one of our newer purchases has been Atrato OnSite Energy. What we've tried to do is steer clear from anywhere that's too exposed to just general power prices. And what Atrato does is they put solar panels on tops of warehouses for companies like Tesco, Britvic, etc. And then they have the this revenue is therefore kind of underpinned with the contracts of these companies. It's really beneficial for the underlying companies because it means that they can hit their net zero targets and they're not as exposed to the power price market themselves. For Atrato, they have this contracted sort of mostly inflation-linked revenue. But investors have sort of, you know, haven't really necessarily separated the wheat from the chaff in terms of these sectors, and everything has fallen kind of in tandem. Whereas actually, you know, we think that this trust is imminently sensible.
So, I mean, there's definitely, you know, lots of bargains out there, but are there any sort of areas where even though stuff looks really cheap, you wouldn't touch, and perhaps why wouldn't you go and sort of invest in this area?
Yeah, there's a couple of areas that we're kind of shying away from. First of all, we've been very nervous about investing in China. So despite the fact that, you know, that the shares probably look very cheap, most Chinese trusts are trading it on wide discounts. For us, we just think that the political uncertainty is too great for us to really get comfortable with investing in China. And then on the other side, I would say battery storage has again been somewhere that we've avoided, despite the fact that obviously these trusts are trading on very large discounts. One of the things that we say in our, you know, part of our process, and one of the things that we say about how we invest is that we're pretty allergic to leverage. So any trust that has a, you know, a high degree of leverage, we would tend to avoid, and that's certainly the case with the battery storage trusts. And also, you just don't have that same predictable revenue. So, you know, discussing Atrato earlier, it's a sort of chalk and cheese in terms of the sort of revenue predictability.
Yeah, I mean, there must be parts of the market where, you know, everything, you know, lots of things looking cheap, investors have sort of identified that and they piled in. So is there any areas in the investment trust world where actually we've seen these sort of discounts narrow and actually they're no longer these sort of big bargains that we might have seen a few months or you know, 6 months, 12 months ago?
Yeah, I mean, investment trusts still look very cheap. They're, you know, as a general sector, discounts are still incredibly wide over the general sector. So you haven't seen an awful lot of you know, seen a bit of narrowing, but there's, you know, certainly, there's still certainly sort of historically wide. I would say one area, and it's pulled back slightly more recently, but sort of the Indian mid-cap space has run up. It had been, you know, very hot there, both in terms of NAV and sort of discount coming in. So, so that's been something that we've been sort of chipping out of the portfolio. It's pulled back slightly after the Central Bank in India sort of made some comments around the frothiness of the market, but you know that area probably still looks not quite as cheap as other areas necessarily. But yeah, in terms of the wider market, there's a few special situations certainly, but in terms of the wider market, I still think there's an enormous amount of opportunities. Things still look very, very cheap.
I have to ask you about the UK equity space. We've just, you know, the FTSE 100s is finally coming to life, new record highs. You know, everyone sort of seems to be talking about the UK stock market for the first time in a very long time. Are you looking for sort of cheap stuff in that space, or do you think it's just there's better things elsewhere that you could be doing with your money?
So we are looking further down the market cap spectrum. So we sort of describe it as Russian doll discounts. So where you have a discount on a discount on a discount. And despite the fact that the UK market has had a bit of a recovery, you know, it does still look incredibly cheap in comparison to its, you know, its peers. And so and as you go further down the market cap spectrum to this sort of small and micro cap area of the market, you know, that valuation gap looks even bigger. And then you have investment trusts that are trading on discount themselves. So we prefer to kind of go down a bit further down the market cap. So something like River and Mercantile Micro Cap, it's trading on a discount whilst also having a, you know, portfolio of smaller micro cap companies, which are trading at very low valuations in a market that is, you know, still got probably room to run. So that's kind of the area that we've got a basket of UK kind of smaller micro cap trusts to to take advantage of that valuation gap.
I guess one of the issues there, though, is that you need a catalyst for those share prices in the underlying portfolio to go up. And I think the small cap space has been, it's been cheap for a very long time. And I think that we've seen some stuff go up, but are we still simply relying on takeovers to get things moving in terms of valuations? Or do you think eventually the market will recognize that there are some really good companies, their profits are growing, and they're just totally being overlooked, but eventually the market will recognize that value?
Yeah, I think we always describe it, if the stock market can't value something properly, then the real world will come and step in. So I think your point on takeovers absolutely stands. And we've for us, we're always trying to identify the catalyst. It's not sufficient for us to just buy a trust because it's on a large discount, or to buy, an area of the market because it's on a large discount. We are always looking for how are we going to extract that value. And certainly one way will be takeovers, because, it makes an awful lot of sense for companies to take out these, smaller microcaps on trading on very low valuations. But we also do think that, the market will turn. And as you say, they have been cheap for a long time. But actually, it would only take a small amount of buying to start moving their share prices. The liquidity is quite poor down the small end of the market. So if we get a movement away from sort of net selling of the UK to net buying, actually, and some more interest in the smaller microcap, then we think that actually you could get some very good returns.
But I guess the illiquid nature of small caps, does that mean that, if you're investing in small cap or micro cap investment trusts, and also sort of perhaps some of these alternative things, does MIGO Opportunities Trust itself trade on a big discount because you've got essentially what the market perceives to be illiquid holdings?
So MIGO itself doesn't trade on a large discount. I believe it's around 4-5% today. The discounts are very much in the underlying portfolio. So our average discount at the moment is about 35%. There is issues sort of around liquidity, but that's the wonderful thing about investment trusts, is that if you're running an open-ended fund, then dealing with liquidity, whether you're running a small or micro cap open-ended, or in any area of the market that you don't have necessarily the easy liquidity as you would in sort of US megatech, for example. A trust, therefore, because you are protected from inflows and outflows, these are a perfect structure to deal with these assets. And that's why I think that investment trusts, despite having been under the cosh for the last 18 months, will actually, are such an integral and important part of the market and should recover.
Yeah, excellent. Well, Charlotte, thank you ever so much for joining us on the podcast. It's been brilliant to talk to you.
Thank you very much.
That was Charlotte Cuthbertson from MIGO Opportunities Trust. We've got time for just one more topic on this week's podcast, and it's private equity. And this sector is pretty topical, as we're about to find out. Over to you, Dan.
So, Alan, the Financial Conduct Authority, the UK financial regulator, has started a review of the private equity sector. I think if we start the conversation off by sort of saying, why is it doing this, and what are its concerns, and what do you think might happen?
Yeah, it's true. I mean, around the turn of the year, we started to see press reports, didn't we, that this might be coming. And then in March, we saw the Dear CEO letter, encompassing a number of different areas, but mentioning to asset managers that the FCA were due to undertake a review of valuation practices for private assets. It seems it's going to be a multi-firm review. And I think the genesis of this is, well, under current regulation, both in the EU and UK, alternative investment managers can undertake the valuation process for their own portfolio. They don't need an independent valuer to come in. And if you look at the wording that the FCA used, I mean, they seem to refer to the fact that there's been enormous growth in private markets, as we know. If you take the part of private markets that I focus on, which is private equity and specifically the buyout space, There are 28,000 companies backed by private equity managers across the globe. That would 10, 20 years ago would be a fraction of that. So that, you know, that the industry has grown so much and is a lot more influential now. Companies are staying private for longer. At the same time, businesses, you know, listed companies are declining in number. So I think it's that sort of the greater influence of private markets and the expectation it will continue to grow. But also in 2022, the fact is private equity companies didn't decline as much as listed companies did on the back of the Ukraine war and, you know, higher inflation and interest rate rises. So that has sparked a lot of commentary around private valuations and how they compare to listed and whether managers are burying their head in the sand, which is an expression I've heard used.
Yeah, because I've seen sort of suggestions that, you know, either these sort of valuations, they're not done frequently enough. So they're not really giving investors sort of a true or a clearer picture of what it's, you know, what these assets are worth today. Now, obviously, investors could, you know, if they can sense something perhaps is overvalued and that there's bad news out there, they could sell now. And then some, you know, if it's an open-ended fund, perhaps that would lead to a rush of people selling it. And then, you know, could this lead to the fund not being able to meet redemptions? Or there's this sort of the idea that people are buying, you know, buying into a private equity product, but thinking it's certain valuation, but it's completely different because you've got to wait, you know, 3-6 months before you actually find out, you know, the next published figure.
Yeah, well, I'm an optimist, so I see this as an opportunity for the industry, frankly, to dispel some of the myths around it. But you'll always have a valuation lag in private equity relative to public equity because you're getting daily pricing in, you know, the public equity market, certainly in terms of the marginal buyer for minority positions in companies. Whereas private equity, you obviously need that time to, you know, get the earnings figures through, apply valuation multiples. That takes a little bit of time. And then, you know, every year at least, these valuations are audited as well, which eats up more time. So you get this lag in private equity, probably around, you know, 2 to 3 months, frankly. So December 31st valuations, for example, have just come in for us, you know, in February, March time. So that's the typical lag that you see. I mean, you know, for those outside the industry, valuation has been a stick to beat private equity with. And it just kind of goes against my own experience of private equity. And look, I've no doubt that there's bad actors there, like there are in any industry. But my experience is that the PE firms that we work with, partner with, and invest with, they have robust governance and process. They manage conflicts appropriately. And there's this view out there that private equity should behave like levered listed equity. And that's just not the case. And I'm happy to go into the detail on that. But what should a valuation be fundamentally is, in my view anyway, what a willing buyer and seller would transact at in an orderly transaction. And, you know, when that happens in our book, over the last 10, 15 years, it's been at an uplift on average to the carrying value 2 quarters prior. So in structured sales processes, private equity tends to sell them an uplift. Now, admittedly, that was in a market that was increasing, you know, more generally and low interest rates. But and whether that sort of uplift persists at those levels, sort of 25% on average, you know, we haven't seen any evidence to the contrary. But that's like an open question for sure.
Yeah, so I think if, you know, if we think that the FCA is looking at this sector, clearly they want to have potential changes here. What can we expect? Is it more transparency, more disclosure? And if that's the case, does that imply actually, you know, the costs are going to go up for the investor because there's going to be more sort of regulatory sort of scrutiny from people involved?
Well, I would hope not. You know, the governance around it already is pretty strong, as I've alluded to. I mean, typically there's independent valuation committees that, you know, comprise mainly of operational people, not the investment deal makers. And then you've also got the annual audit, as I alluded to. You have, in some cases, the involvement of third-party valuation experts. And yeah, I think there isn't that much of an incentive for a private equity firm to overvalue, because their management fees are based on cost and commitments, not on value. The vast majority of PE firms, that's the case. And then their carried interest, their performance fee, is based on the cash returned back. And then all of our firms that you know, in our portfolio, they value in line with international private equity guidelines in terms of accounting standards, IFRS or US GAAP. So a lot of governance there. So I would like to think, you know, this process, this review, would be a confirmation that it isn't at all the Wild West. There's a lot of good stuff happening here, that there's a good deal of proper process in place. But, you know, the general movement is towards more regulation rather than less, isn't it? So, you know, potentially there might be new measures introduced which come at a cost, I suppose.
So I think over the last 6 months, we've seen shares in private equity companies and also private equity investment trusts have been sort of slowly moving up. And that sort of implies, you know, risk appetite is returning. So, I mean, what are you seeing at the moment? Do you think that investors are sort of saying, well, you've had a couple of years where a very sharp rise in interest rates is negative for sort of the world of private equity and sort of the sector? Now people are sort of happy to take another look. Are you seeing that? Or also, does it sort of affect potential deals you're doing? Are more sort of private companies looking for finance, or perhaps is it easier for you to sell stuff in the portfolio that you've got?
I mean, there's a lot of nuance in that. I think still private equity investment trusts are competing with the fact that, you know, government gilts are, you know, you've got a, you know, suddenly they're sort of 5%, say cash is 4 or 5% and or more, you know, suddenly you're competing against that environment, and people have generally been a bit more risk off. And that's why I think you've seen these discounts come out, you know, quite to incredible levels, in fact, in the last couple of years. I think it's a real opportunity for those that want to take a long-term view, you know, at those sort of levels. But yeah, I think there's an element of, you know, the markets fell quite, you know, quite a lot in 2022 and say 20% range, but they've returned to similar levels through 2023. And so people kind of taking the view that, well, you know, even if private equity valuations, you know, aren't perfect, the reality is the markets are more or less where they were, with, you know, and so there's probably an element of that sort of risk is somewhat mitigated. There's probably an element of people seeing a bit more certainty around interest rates more generally, and then taking a look at the fact that these discounts have never been, well, they've only been as wide as they are now during the start of COVID and the GFC. And a lot of these private equity trusts are, you know, 2-3 decades old. So they've been around a long time, and they've delivered over a long period of time. And the last thing on the trusts, I would say that you know, there has been a lot of buyback activity as well. So those share prices and share price increases have been driven as well in part by buybacks, not just pure natural buyer interest. For the PE industry more broadly, it's been a difficult time over the last couple of years, because the sharp rise in interest rates has meant that it's become very difficult to price assets, and debt is less readily available and obviously more expensive. But more importantly, it's kind of caused a bit of a bid-ask spread. You know, buyers and sellers' expectations have been almost too far apart. We're hearing a lot of noise in the market right now about the fact that there's there's certainly a lot more of a positive sentiment, and we haven't seen that translate into more deal flow, but we'd expect as we go into the second half of the year, we'll start to see a lot more deals getting signed, a lot more momentum in the market. Again, because interest rates is a bit more certainty and probably take a bit longer for cuts to come through, but there's a bit more certainty there. And private equity managers still have a lot of money to spend. There's 1.2 trillion of dry powder, as they call it in the industry, capital raised that's not yet been invested. So I expect activity to come back fairly soon.
So do you think that deals could be done using existing cash resources? Because obviously over the years, people talk about private equity being able to, well, certainly over the last 10 years up until a couple of years ago, being able to borrow money cheaply to finance deals. It doesn't really matter, does it, that rates are a lot higher now if they've got cash to do deals?
Well, it does matter. I mean, look, let's be honest. I mean, the sort of decade and a bit following the global financial crisis, when low interest rates has been, you know, the most fertile ground that private equity could have because of the use of leverage. But I think at the same time, private equity firms have become more specialist in terms of sector and value creation. Their abilities to add value to their underlying businesses just have grown so much and much greater than they used to be. So there's an element of that as well as we look forward, and as PE gets more specialist and becomes more about adding value over and above company management plan, that's still a compelling part of the private equity story, where you have a governance model, an ownership model, where majority control is taken or a significant minority. I think that can be really powerful. But coming to the point around leverage and general use of that, we've seen leverage ticking down over the years, to be honest. It used to be the case when, you know, prior to the global financial crisis, you would have leverage packages where the majority of the debt of the structure is debt, or at least sort of 50-50. Now it's commonplace for no debt to be used, or for debt levels to be somewhere between, you know, 30 and 50% of the overall capital structure. So we've definitely seen the use of leverage in absolute terms fall. And then also the debt packages are a lot more flexible, a lot more covenant light, and a lot of the managers and most of the managers tend to hedge interest rates. So there's that element to it. But fundamentally, it comes back to this point that deals done during these periods of dislocation tend to be amongst the best deals done in private equity. You've seen that in the back of the dot-com bubble. You saw that in the back of the GFC. When pricing's a bit more reasonable, when long-held assets come to market, that, you know, PE tends to do quite well during these periods. And it's simply that the entry pricing of these assets will reflect the capital structure that the PE firms can raise and the cost of debt. And that's probably one of the reasons why the bid-ask spread between buyers and seller expectations has been kind of a bit too wide in recent times, because some sellers haven't adjusted to the new reality, I suppose.
That was Alan Gold from Patria Private Equity Opportunities. Now, it's recently been renamed, so it's possible that you know it as the Aberdeen Private Equity Opportunities Trust.
So that's all we have time for this week. The normal AJ Bell Money Markets podcast will be back in a few days' time. So until then, thanks very much for listening, and we'll catch you next time.
Before you go, please remember this podcast is for educational purposes, and the views expressed don't necessarily reflect those of AJ Bell or Shares Magazine. The podcast isn't telling you if a certain investment is suitable or not. Don't forget that the value of investments can change, and you can lose money as well as make it. It's also important to remember that how you're taxed will depend on your individual circumstances, and rules can change. The way an investment performed in the past may not be the same as how it behaves in the future. If you want help, go see a qualified financial advisor.